Welcome to the Effortless Swimming Podcast, the show that helps swimmers and triathletes love the water, become a better swimmer, and live a better life. Here's your host, Brenton Ford.
Welcome to the Effortless Swimming Podcast. My guest today is someone who was on a couple of years back, and we were talking about fueling and how to test physiology for endurance sports. And I've got Nick from Mets Performance back on the podcast because they've recently got some new equipment in the lab where they can test things in a little bit more detail and get better numbers around what's required for fueling when it comes to doing Ironman events, doing any sort of long distance events. And so I want to get stuck into the details and the data with what you're looking at the moment. So Nick, welcome back to the podcast.
Now, good to be back on.
So tell me about the recent upgrade in equipment that you've got in the lab, and how does that improve the ability for you guys to look at what's required in terms of fueling for these long distance events?
Yeah, so I guess the simple explanation is that the really major change is we just can measure carbon dioxide. So for those who don't really understand the capability of that, it's all of our old equipment and most metabolic devices, or all metabolic devices, have a capability to measure oxygen consumption, which is great and tells us a lot of information around training zones, what we can implement in terms of training strategy, etc. But it doesn't tell us necessarily about the breakdown of fuel utilization. It can tell us how much energy is required, but we don't know, well, what's the percentage fat versus carb, or how many grams an hour of carbohydrate, for example, are we expending at a particular intensity? And that's where being able to measure someone's carbon dioxide production can be really, really critical, because now we can have a look at, well, what's the ratio between carbon dioxide being produced and oxygen consumption being taken in? Basically, take that CO2 number, divide it by VO2. We then get an understanding of what's the breakdown versus fat versus carb. And essentially that comes from more carbon dioxide being produced is an indicator that more carbohydrates being utilized. So that really is just kind of an add-on to what we're already able to look at to then enable us to be a bit more refined in, well, how do we understand and assess someone's ability to utilize different fuels at different intensities, and how do they do that? But then also off the back end, how can we manipulate or utilize some of that data to best inform how an athlete would be able to fuel up for a race? We've already been able to be pretty good at understanding maybe their pacing in the past and relative percentage of physiology, but now it's taking it that one step further to just open up that last little bit, which we know a lot of endurance athletes, they train the house down, they race pretty well, but then just fall over on the fueling side of things. And this is a way for us to get a clearer insight on how could we maybe get ahead of that and be able to ultimately prevent a little bit of that bonking effect or fuel flat that most people sort of feel middle to back end of races. Like, can we eliminate that as a bit of a factor so that the race can go as best you can the whole way through? And in particular, we're really talking the long distance stuff. So most of this data is only really going to be massively important for those events that go for 2, 2.5, 3 hours plus. I think shorter than that, not as massive requirement in terms of the fueling. And most people intuitively know, like if you're a 10K runner, probably not going to need to take much fuel if your race is done in 40 odd minutes. Whereas when you're out there for 4, 5, 7, 10, 15 hours, however long, yeah, it's pretty important that we get the fuel back in, and we do it in a way that is going to mean we get the most out of ourselves, but maintain as much of our performance as we can.
So what are the issues that you would come across when someone's not fueling correctly? Like, you talk about overfueling, underfueling, the maybe taking it on the wrong type of fuel as well. So like, what are those issues that people do run into?
Yeah, the classic ones are like gastrointestinal upset is the classic one, like a feeling of sickness, vomiting, whatever it might be. That can come from a few different means. It can be set up by what you ate in the days leading in. So what was your fueling strategy leading in to the event? Are you more sensitive to certain types of foods? But day to day in your training, probably it's neither here nor there, but in a race circumstance, when the pace is on, you're working hard, you're then trying to smash in something quite potent like a gel or lots of sports drinks, whatever it might be, you might have already delivered a bit of gut damage there. So heading into the race, you're kind of setting yourself up for a little bit of failure there. So that can be part of it. But then the other ones are like significantly overfueling, never really ends well. And also significantly overfueling, like there's probably an argument to say, if you're taking it a bit much on the bike and then a little less on the run, it kind of can balance it out a little bit. But like, if you're consistently way over, a good example, just arbitrary numbers here would be like, if someone only needed 80 grams of carbs an hour, but they were trying to take 120, just because it's more doesn't necessarily mean it's better. in your individual circumstance. For other athletes, it might, but for you, it might not. And then what you end up with is a bunch of carbs sitting in your gut. We get redistribution of blood flow away from your digestive system in endurance. So the more you work, the more you start sweating, blood flow goes away from the guts. Okay, it's harder to break down. So what's it going to do? It's just going to sit there. And that's that sick feeling you're starting to get. You just aren't able to break it down. So over can be an issue. The other side of things is maybe not necessarily from a gastrointestinal upset, but significant underfueling is the one that probably most of us at some point in time have experienced, of hitting the wall. And you just go, I just feel like I can't, I don't feel too bad, but I just feel like I can't produce the intensity. Workload drops. Why? Well, we're running out of carbohydrate. We don't have the capacity to get enough back in. So we have to start utilizing fat as more of a fuel source. What does that mean? Well, if we're doing that, it requires more oxygen, and it takes longer time to break down to get the same energy requirement. So our intensity has to drop. So you feel not too bad. You just have that sensation of, I just can't keep going at the same pace I was before. That's probably the other side of it when you get that fueling wrong, more so from an underfueling perspective rather than the over. But then it also comes down to like, well, what was the combination? And you pointed out there, like taking sports drinks, gels, like those who can, like you ask most athletes, like they typically go, oh, gels and fluids is a bit easier. And yeah, the more simple the source, or the more liquid, I guess, if you want to put it on a scale of solids through to liquids, the more liquid, typically the easier it is to get down. But I mean, some athletes can take bars and solids. That's great. What's within that? Even in the more highly or the easier stuff to get down, like fluids and gels, like what's the mix? The classic one that's been around for a number of years that most to be aware of is, well, a bit of research showed that 60 grams of glucose was all we can really absorb in an hour. So how do I get 80 or 90 in? Well, I have to use something like a fructose or a different method of transporting that carbohydrate, or a different kind of carbohydrite, which is where we start to see the maltodextrins, the sucrose, like different combinations, these 2-to-1 mixes in gels now. But positive in that regard, we can get more in. Negative, like if you've got an intolerance to fructose, gels that have a high amount of fructose in them are going to be no good. Like, so there's a lot of individuality that has to come into play here to get that fueling aspect right. And as we mentioned before, I mean, like that's where some of the testing can come into it to understand, well, how much do you actually need to dial in the amount of fuel to put back in, which makes it then a little bit easier to navigate that. Like it can help prevent you from significantly overfueling, or if you need a lot of carbs, well, what is actually the best method? What ratio for you is going to be a little bit better? What sits best in your guts? Practicalities, like some guys might want to go all fluids, but if you're in an Ironman, you're on the bike and you can only carry maybe 2, maybe a third bottle, is that going to be enough of your own customized nutrition to get you through the bike leg, or are you going to have to pick up on course, and how does that change the dynamic? So that individual aspect plays a big role in terms of then getting that right. And as a result, we've got all these factors laid out. There's so many more. You can see why a lot of athletes do often get it wrong.
Yeah, exactly right. There's just so many different factors, right? So how would you recommend someone figure out what works for them? So obviously the testing, I want to talk about how you do the testing in a moment, but how would you recommend that someone, say in training, I guess, to figure out what they can hold, what tastes good, what they can keep down, that sort of thing?
Well, the obvious thing is you have to practice what you're about to race with, at the very least, at an equal amount in the exact nutrition, like cut like 4-6 weeks before, ideally. So the latest, it's like you should have a couple of times in your training gone out, practiced exactly what the race nutrition is going to look like, because you'll find out really, really quickly in a training session if that's going to work or not. The number of times I've had conversations where an athlete, and it might not have even been their own fault in terms of, I lost a gel out the back of my pocket coming off the bike. And so I got onto the run and I had to pick up a different brand on course. And I had no issues in training. And then on the day, I just had a gastrointestinal upset because the gel was a different brand. It was a different mix. Like, so something like that can be a bit of an issue. So going and practicing it like anything else in your race, like you practice your swim, bike, run, you go and practice your transitions, you practice being aero, like those things we need to practice. But you need to practice, what does your nutrition look like? Because then you'll get a pretty good feel of what feels about right. You don't have to necessarily go and completely race your whole race 4 weeks out to then go, oh, it's the exact intensity I've done. What would that like? Some practicalities involved of getting it close to, but for the most part, you'll have a pretty good idea of, well, can I tolerate like 10 gels across a 3-hour ride, for example? You'll know pretty quick because you get pretty sick pretty quick. Persist with it a bit, but if it's constantly an issue of, okay, after the 7th gel, I have issues, but anything 7 gels or less, I don't. Okay, maybe the additional source of carbohydrate has to come through fluids. So there's a bit of trial and error of what your body responds to, tolerates, what you like. Things like flavor fatigue are big. Like you want to do this a couple of times, but don't use your favorite gel all the time, because then when you get to race day, like if you're sick of it before you even start, you're probably not going to want to take it in. Like, how do you respond to caffeinated gels versus non-caffeinated gels is a good example. Some people don't have really any difference. Some people find they get a different response when you add caffeine into the mix. So like, first and foremost, go out, train, practice it. Start pretty cautiously. So I'd probably, if you're doing this practically with no data insights, like I'd start on the lower side, take a little bit less than you think, train through, and you can gradually sort of raise that and sort of see where that limit is of, okay, I'm probably tipping the limit of feeling a bit sick here versus like, well, what do I need? And you're typically going to find a pretty good mark. Like often you find most people are going to be pretty okay, depending the type of event. Like if we want to use IMA as an example, like most people should be pretty okay somewhere between 70 to 90 grams an hour. And this is if we're taking in most people's body size, like that all plays a factor. Most males in particular are going to be like 70 to 90. You're probably going to be okay as an amateur. It's still a broad range. And that's why you just need to go and do a bit of trial and error if you don't have any data. If you do have the data though, then it's easier because we can pinpoint, well, what are we trying to race at as an intensity? Well, what does that mean as a grams of carbohydrate being used per hour as an example? So that it's a little bit more plug and play to narrow that target or even start looking at, we know, and people hear all the time, it's like, well, the pros are using 120, 130, 140 grams an hour potentially or higher. Well, okay, there's a reason for that because they're riding like average or normalized powers of like 320 watts for 90K. Like it's significantly greater than what the average amateur can hold. So there's an added energy expenditure in that. Most of us who are riding mid to low 200s, as an example, in a 70.3, probably don't need to be fueling at 120 grams an hour. You're just probably not expending that much energy. So, or there's a way that maybe we could keep the energy expenditure down by just focusing on a different part of our performance. But baseline point is like, you just have to go and practice it. And then probably the second part to that is once you get a bit of a strategy and you go, okay, I reckon this is going to be pretty good. Let's say that was 80 grams an hour. The one I like to do is go out a couple of times with some more difficult sources than what you're going to take on race day. So training session might be, instead of taking all my stuff through gels and fluids like I'm going to do on race day, I'm going to try and do a couple of those gels and some of that fluids as some solids. So maybe take some bananas with you or bars, chews, whatever it might be. Not with any intent to use them on race day, but just to get you a little bit more comfortable with some gut tolerance. Whether it has a significant effect or not, it's a bit debatable literature-wise, but arguably it's like most of the anecdotal evidence is most people go out, they train with a bit more difficult source, body gets a little bit better or they feel a little bit better at breaking it down and keeping it down so that when they take the gels and the fluids, it's like, this feels nice and easy. I can get it down. It's not an issue on race day. And the icing on the cake to that would be, if you're going to race at 80 grams an hour, if you could train maybe at 85 or 90 grams an hour a couple of times just to give you a taste of that harder stuff, you then go back on race day and you race a little bit lower, you're pretty good. They're sort of some practical ones you can use before you get into the details of testing.
And what about how regularly you should be taking it in? Do you have a sort of rule of thumb? Does it differ for people? What's that timeline look like?
Yeah, it's going to differ. It's going to differ a little bit. And then ultimately it's going to differ a bit based on the source you're taking in. So something like if you're going solids and bars, of course they're going to take a bit longer to break down. So you're clearly not going to have to take it in as frequently. Like you probably don't need to put a power bar, for example, down every 20 minutes. You'd make yourself sick really quick. Typically gels, like again, pending the race and how much you're trying to get back in and what the size of the gel is, like the precision, like 90 gram gels now, like the massive ones, you might want to take a third of that every half hour, for example. Like that might work. Often we tend to see gels sort of every 20 to 30 minutes is a pretty typical window for most athletes are pretty comfortable with. Fluids is kind of a a floating one of it plays a bit into your hydration. So how much fluid are you taking on is probably going to be a little bit linked to how thirsty you feel as well. Some days you might be taking more fluids more regularly. Other days you might take bigger blocks of fluid, like every 30 to 40 minutes. Typically, like something like a gel, like if you worked off a strategy of, I'm going to take it roughly every 30 odd minutes in a race, as an example, probably isn't going to be too much of an issue. It's then more looking at like, well, what's the big picture? Like if I'm going to be on the bike for four, five, 6 hours, however long, or I'm out there running for 3 hours, 4 hours, whatever it might be, what is my total energy requirement likely to be? What do I need to get overall to kind of manage that deficit? And then ultimately, like how much do I need to put in an hour to kind of keep me in the range? Once you get that, like, and this is where the testing is useful. It's like, now you can start to go, well, that does probably mean a gel at least every 40 minutes. And so you can now go, okay, if a gel's got 24 grams, you can start to calculate it out and work out that spacing. But then the individual play is like, if you're feeling like you're needing a bit of extra fuel, like you're going, oh, I'm starting to fade a little here, back end of a run or whatever it might be, like, top yourself up. Like it's probably a pretty clear sign, no different to when you, from a dehydration perspective, if you feel thirsty, drink. Like that's not a bad thing. Like your body's telling you it needs more fluid. So if you can tune yourself to understand that sort of change as well, like you're probably going to be able to adjust that on the fly. But I've never been a big fan, nutrition or hydration wise, of here is the exact, you cannot deviate from every 20 minutes. You have to take this gel every 20, but it's like there's a lot more play to that and what happens in the race circumstance that you need to be a little bit more flexible with. Something as simple as aid stations. Like, okay, we know where they are in an Ironman course, but we get to race day and there's a howling headwind. So it's going to take you 10 minutes longer to get to that aid station. You don't want to run out of gels 20 minutes ago. And you still got another 10 minutes. And now you've got nothing to get through for half an hour till you get to the aid station. And you're like, oh, now I have to pick something up. And it's probably a bit late and you're scrambling. Your best plan might have been great, but it gets thrown out the window because of a headwind. So like there's a little bit of back and forth. So I always encourage a little bit of flexibility with that. Have a clear idea of where you roughly want to be, but then it's a case of be flexible with what happens on race day, how it plays out, and be flexible with, okay, if things go wrong, well, what's my backup plan? Or if I lose a bottle, what's my backup plan? How much am I going to pick up, or how can I make that up or substitute it? Which that's where I've always liked some of the brands that have very seamless nutrition. Like a good example is like back when, I think they're still around, Proformance was a thing. It's like on the side of their gels and their like drink mix, it was like the same combination. So however, like I can't remember the exact numbers, but like however many scoops of your drink mix meant it equal to gel, etc. Like if you can know that kind of maths, and a lot of brands have that now, but like if you know that kind of maths, it gives you more of that flexibility when things go wrong to then make decisions on the fly to then either get back on track or make up for something you've lost. But apart from anything, the psychological stress of I didn't take a gel, like my race is blown up, like no, like yeah, missed a gel in the 20 minute mark and you took it on the 23, like it's probably going to be pretty insignificant.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about with training sessions? So is there kind of a with training sessions, let's say it goes for an hour, is that something that you should be fueling for? And then if not, what sort of point should someone start to take on some sort of nutrition with their training sessions, depending on the duration? Because most people are probably swimming for, I'd say, 45 minutes to an hour. Some people would then be going an hour to an hour 30. And then if you're doing some probably more endurance-based swimming or longer distance swimming, you'll have some sessions that are in the 2 hours, possibly more, if you're training for, you know, doing a solid 8K to 10K session. But what are your thoughts there with the duration of sessions and when you should start to take fuel on?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting one from a training perspective, and definitely like there's a little bit more noise around it, I reckon, particularly from what the Norwegian triathlon program's doing. Like, and they put it really well. They talk about like a calorie budget. So everything that we do is essentially governed by energy in versus energy out. Like, so if you look at a typical swimming week of, I don't know, keep it simple, if you swam every day of the week, so 7 days a week, 7 sessions, within that, you're probably going to have some sessions that are longer, sessions that are shorter, more intense, less intense. Realistically, like across that whole week, there is there is an amount of energy you are going to have to expend to get through all seven of those sessions. As long as you are fueled up appropriately for that and can balance that out effectively, you should get to the end of the week and like the calories that were expended were pretty much met by the calories that you put back in. So where it starts to become interesting is some sessions you probably won't have to fuel. You go and do a nice, easy 30, 40 minute sort of recovery swim. Cool. You're probably not going to need to take a lot there. Having said that, if you had a like an hour and a half swim in the morning, big, long endurance set, we're just accumulating some volume, you probably want to fuel up within the back end of that. If you had to jump back in the pool later that day and double up and do a second session, because there's only so many opportunities for you to get that fuel back in. Okay, it's low intensity. You're not expending a lot at the time, and you could probably make that up pretty well immediately afterwards by like, you jump in first thing in the morning, you have a bit of a meal afterwards, you're probably okay. But what we're actually looking for there is the fueling during that session is probably actually just trying to get you ahead for the next one where you're going to jump in and do some hard hundreds, 50s, whatever it might be. Intensity's up, energy expenditure's up. So we're not necessarily fueling for now. We're kind of fueling for that future as well. If you approach your week kind of like that, you'll start to see opportunities where it's like, yeah, I probably do need to maybe top up a bit more here. You might get through and go, yeah, okay, all I've got today is an hour, pretty easy. Tomorrow's going to be a rest day. Well, yeah, you're going to have more than enough time to fuel up off the back of that hour, the rest of that day, the rest of the following day, big hard session on the following day after that. You go, okay, I'm pretty topped up, ready to go for it, but I know this is going to be a big energy cost. So what is then coming up after that? Do I now need to fuel in that big hard session for then the day after that? But I think, yeah, that perspective of looking at the whole week and going, well, I'm going to need fuel for everything here, but where are the more important sessions where I definitely need a lot, where I'm going to be expending a lot more, aka longer, more intense typically. And as a result, you can start to play around with, okay, session leading into that, probably need to take a little bit more. Having said that as well, like you then look at some opportunities in the week where you're like, probably okay to be on pretty low fuel. If I had a solid day yesterday, I fueled up though, have a kind of rest day, and then I'm going into like an hour of just cruisy, like volume building, aerobic Ks, maybe some technique work. You could potentially go into that session off the back of a rest day where you fueled up heaps. You can then go to sleep overnight, basically be 10 hours faster, jump in the pool, do an hour and not have any issues, fuel up afterwards and go. So you can start to build this sort of undulation throughout the week and plan for it in terms of, so that kind of looks at it less traditionally than often it would normally be. Well, you fuel in your long sessions because you're in there for a long time. Like you get past an hour, you're going to be starting to need maybe a little bit anyway. If it's sort of less than 40 minutes, you probably more often than not don't need to take much or anything at all, maybe tiny bits. Like from a sport performance perspective, recommendation on nutrition, typically it's like anything less than 60 minutes. Most of the time you don't really worry about, like if you want to take something, it's pretty minimal. Like you might, like one that gets thrown around in different environments, probably not the swimming side of things, but like team sport would be like carbohydrate rinsing. So if it's a short, intense game of basketball, you might not want to actually drink a lot of calories or eat a lot, but you might just swirl some Gatorade in your mouth and spit it back out. And we actually get a little like sort of neurological stimulus from that that can aid a bit of performance. We get out to 90 minutes. Okay, you probably want to take a little bit, two and a half hours plus is more the length of session we're looking at where it's like you kind of have to be taking something now. If you were to time trial pretty much as solid as you could go for 90 minutes, pretty fair to say by the end of that 90, you're pretty much going to be out of carbohydrate. So like that, if the intensity's down and you go a bit longer, it's like, yeah, I'm probably going to have to fuel. If the intensity's up, but it's a bit shorter, yeah, maybe I need a bit as well. They're the kind of levers we can start to pull. But often anything really 60 minutes or less, it's kind of like there's going to be a low need to put carbs in at the time, but you like that doesn't mean you don't then finish the session, jump out and don't take anything in for hours. It's like, well, you would just have to make sure you're taking in something immediately post to top up what you've expended. But as I said before, like if you're doing like double training days, like that's probably the one that for me where I go, a lot of athletes who do a session, don't take fuel during, just try and top up afterwards and then get into another session, might be missing out a little bit there. It might just be an opportunity to get some extra fuel early, bank that, you're still expending at the time, finish that session, have a bit of a rest. Sure, you can get some in, but based on time pressures, et cetera, you might
have a huge amount of time, get to the second session. You just want to make sure that you're meeting the requirements enough, because it's pretty easy when the Ks go up or volume goes up week to week. Most endurance athletes know it's pretty easy to then start seeing the weight come down pretty quickly on the scales. And really a lot of that is, well, I'm in a deficit typically, like I'm taking in not enough calories for what I'm expending, which if you're trying to get the weight down, not too bad. If you're trying to maintain performance and in the session and you don't really want the weight down, well, clearly we're not putting enough back in. So are we missing an ability to push harder in those sessions because you don't have the fuel to do it? Maybe.
Yeah. It's, I think in swimming in particular, it's like probably notorious for not really fueling within sessions. And I'm guilty of that as well. And if towards the end of a session, if you are training for an hour and a half and you're doing some pretty solid work in there, yeah, you're likely to start to feel it in that last 15 to 20 minutes. But yeah, it's just something that I think because we're in the pool, we haven't really got a, you do have options to fuel, but it's just something that's probably less considered than it is for the running or the riding, I think. So I've told this on the podcast quite a few times, but every year we do 100 hundreds, we do a 10K swim prior to Christmas. And it's only been the last 2-3 years that I've actually fueled properly. And I've gotten faster through that 100 hundreds because I've kind of loosened up, gotten into the groove, and I've got that fuel to use. Whereas 10 years ago when we were doing that, I would fade so hard in those last 3100s, and it's all no surprise because I've had probably 30 grams, maybe 40 grams of carbs an hour when it really had to be probably twice that. So yeah, just that is a realization that came really late to me, but in hindsight, it's just so obvious. But it's just one of those things that I've never really considered because it wasn't, you know, with swimming, it's lots of intervals. Our events are very short, but the training sessions are often quite long. So I think it's just something as a kid, we never really considered a whole lot of. It was, are you drinking enough? But not really about the fuel side of it.
Yeah. And that's where like 100 hundreds, it's a great example of like, it's probably an extreme end of no one's really going out and doing that session as a regular session. But you think about that principle of you get to that same point, you feel like you're starting to fade. From a training perspective, if you're getting to that point in training sessions and you feel like you're starting to fade, just think about the difference of, well, if I can prevent that fading effect or enhance my ability to maintain the quality through that back end of the session, logically, it has to have a better training stimulus, doesn't it? It's like if there was, if you get through 100 hundreds out of that, or you get through 60 or 70 of them pretty good, and then you start fading in the last 30, if that was actually a training stimulus as the example, I go, imagine the difference consistently if you were able to hit those extra 20, even extra 20 or 30, like typically 30 of those efforts more consistently all the way through, like because you've got the energy to do it. Well, if you were then applying that to a race circumstance where you had to go and do a 10K, or you were racing, if your race was 100 hundreds as a race as quick as you could, then it's kind of like, or as consistent as you could, you go, I'm going to be better served because I've got better training stimulus because I'm not fading. I could keep the same pace up for another 20 reps, which means the muscular endurance component has got a far greater stimulus. Like we're influencing these other factors as well. And that's the important bit. It's like if you've got the fuel there, your training quality typically when that volume is up there is just going to be a bit higher. And if any way we can get your training quality higher, largely is going to mean we're going to recover. Like if you can recover better from that, you're probably going to perform better off the back.
And I'd even say too, probably with other sports as well, but for swimming, you're going to maintain your form and your technique a lot better because you can hold those positions and hold that technique, which is going to be training better technique. But on the other side of that too is when you do fatigue and you might be rotating more and you're dropping your arm and you know, you're compromising some of those positions. So that can lead to injury as well. So I think it's got benefits outside of what you mentioned as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And now, just in terms of the testing, where should someone start? So someone who's an endurance athlete, whether that's long distance swimming or you know, triathlons, long distance running, what would you say would be necessary things for them to do if they are considering their fueling? As in, when they come to someone like you, what are those couple of tests that you think this is what you need to do? This podcast is proudly brought to you by Form Smart Swim Goggles. The Smart Swim 2 is the next generation of Form's award-winning augmented reality technology. They have an integrated heart rate monitor for constant real-time heart rate monitoring, which allows you to accurately train your heart rate zones, which is the first time that you can do this in the pool. Something we've had when biking and running, but the first time that you can now do it in the pool. Another huge feature that they have released is the swim straight feature. This is something that allows you to swim in a straight line without needing to sight. It's a digital compass in the goggle display, and it's race approved by World Triathlon, USA Triathlon, as well as other leading race organizers. And athletes are already shaving valuable time off their swims by swimming straighter. I'm a huge fan of these goggles. I've used them for the last couple of years, and it's something that I use each and every week. And even just the simplest features of being able to see your splits after every turn makes a huge difference to not only the way that you train, but the enjoyment that you can have in the pool. And the new Smart Swim 2 has a reduced tech pack size by 15%, making them slightly smaller. The new eye seals fit a wider variety of facial structures, and the new straps and anchor points have been moved and adjusted so that it has a more stable fit. There's additional features which I haven't mentioned, like the head coach workouts, training plans, as well as integrations with Training Peaks, Strava, and more. This is something for all abilities and levels of swimmer, and available worldwide from formswim.com/effortless. And to get 10% off the Smart Swim 1 goggles, use the code EFFORTLESSSWIM on checkout. That's formswim.com/effortless and use the code EFFORTLESSSWIM on checkout for 10% off the Smart Swim 1 goggles.
Yeah, so there's kind of like the way we've sort of split it up is for the most part, you need pretty long periods of time to assess like a specific intensity. So we've identified as like, we really want at least sort of 5 minutes at a particular intensity. So often that can look a bit like a step test. Like traditionally where we looked at like things like VO2 max, you do like 1 minute or 3 minute step tests and things like that. You probably want a bit longer time to steady state to look at it. We sort of provide that as a bit of a starting point for most amateur athletes in particular. If we're looking really at the refined end though, I go for the elite and pro side of things, you can go much longer and you can kind of get as specific as you like in terms of, and I have a discussion with guys around, do we want to come in and do half an hour at race intensity, or do we want to get you on the trainer for like, we were discussing this the other day with a guy, it's like, do we want to get you on the trainer for 3 hours, like not put anything on, and then we'll start assessment at the end of that 3 hours because we've put you in a very specific state. So like you can go quite extreme with that. I guess the purpose is, well, what are we trying to look for? But then it's also like, well, practicalities. I mean, not everyone's got the time to be able to come in, ride for 3 hours on the bike at race intensity and then be able to go and assess what does their fuel utilization look like at the end of that. So we sort of look at a bit of like a 5 minute step test, go up very gradually in intensity, not trying to get you to max at all. Like, as I mentioned right at the start, that fat carb contribution really kind of is only important to us until we get what we call a value of one as a respiratory quotient. So that would indicate 100% carbohydrate. That pretty much lines up with most people's threshold. So that like that traditional like 40 to an hour. So anything above that, 100% carbohydrate. So it's kind of like, it's not really relevant to us. We want everything from below that to look at that percentage split. So yeah, we'll put someone on the bike, say 5 minutes at something really low, maybe like 100 watts. And then every 5 minute block, you might go at 20 or 30 watts very gradually until we get up to that sort of threshold point, call the test there, because that gives us more than enough scope to look at those refined intensities. But then where I see this working really effectively is doing this as part of that lead up preparation. So you might have 6 or 8 or so weeks before a key event. You've got a pretty good idea of where you're going to be sitting. Like there might be some added little fitness you might gain on the top, but we're not talking you're going to be 20% better in that time. You might be a couple of percent better over that last 6 weeks. So a good example would be from a triathlon sense, like on the bike, okay, we're pretty confident based on your training, based on all of your other data and some assessment we might've done previously at the start of your prep. It's pretty clear you might be able to hold roughly between 220 to 250 watts throughout the Ironman. Like that's kind of the range you're going, I reckon it's somewhere there. Let's try and narrow it in. This is where this testing becomes really useful, because then we can look really specifically at, well, what do you like at 200? What do you like at 220? What do you like at 240? What do you like at 260? That there is going to be very clear as to
the energy requirement, the fat versus carb utilization at each of those intensities, to then also make a clear picture of 200 watts. Yeah, like you might be 70-30 split in favor of fat utilization. Awesome. Like you're super effective. You get the 220, it's like, yeah, it's still pretty good. You go to 240 watts and now it's kind of 70-30 the other way. Like that's a bit of a break point for you. Okay, pretty clear that if you're going to try and race on that limit of 240, 250, is that doable from a carbohydrate utilization? Maybe, maybe not. Whereas, say, 220 could be really effective, like based on how many grams an hour you're utilizing. Let's like arbitrary numbers. Let's say it was like 120 grams an hour you're using at that intensity, 110. Well, a lot of people can sort of put that back or get close to putting that back in, especially on the bike. So you go, we could kind of be not net zero completely because you'll never be, but pretty close to minimizing how much we've actually expended or got left by the time we've expended and put it back in by the end of the bike. You go up that stage, up 20, 30 watts. It's like, well, now this is becoming unrealistic for us in terms of what we can carry, how much we can actually put in and tolerate. So looking at that timing, as I said, like 6 to 8 weeks, then gives you that scope to take that information. And as we mentioned before, go and practice it and go and actually see, well, how does this work practically? What do I have to carry with me? How much, how often? You can plan out that. Does that now mean it's 20, 30, 40 minutes apart, those gels? Or so it gives you that ability to go and play with it. We're still enough time before race day to still tweak and refine some of that individual adjustment or that sort of trial and error aspect that you have to do with some parts of it. At least we've narrowed the gap really, really close to go, this is pretty much where we're at. Go jump in your training session, see how that plays around, then we can make some further adjustments. So then you're not going straight into a race off, oh, well, we tested on Monday and I was feeling a little bit fatigued because I hadn't fully finished my taper yet. Like, oh, okay, Nick said I probably need to take about 85 grams now, but I've been training at 60, races on Sunday. The first time I'm going to do it is race day. Terrible idea. So that's where I sort of see that part of it working really effectively. The bonus of our new equipment though is like at the beginning of a preparation, you could still assess that to then have a look at, well, what has changed over a training block. So over a 12-week block at 220 watts, have we become less reliant on carbohydrate as a result of our significant increase in aerobic form or fitness? Like how is that profile slightly shifted? You can get some insights there and we can get some of that little bit of insight from our typical testing protocols that we do when we look at things like VO2 max. Like we're still assessing that carbon dioxide production in the background. It's just most accurate when you get those longer periods to let it really stabilize and steady state and intensity. And ultimately that's what you're doing on race day. Like most of these events, we're talking 2.5, 3 hours, 4 hours plus. You're not going to be very volatile in your intensity. It's going to be pretty consistent, pretty constant. So we want to lock in and get a really accurate representation of where you're at there. So yeah, there's a number of ways you can do it, but the way we're finding is going to be quite effective and practical to then come in, do a session and get some pretty close numbers is doing something like a 5-minute little step test to then get some more clarity and really zone in. And I think that's an important one to remember here is like, we're not necessarily claiming to be able to 100% be like, bang, this is the number, this is exactly what you need to take and it's going to be foolproof. It's not like it's narrowing the focus as close as we can because we understand that there are so many other little variables. Like hot conditions, most people expend more calories in hot conditions, so we can talk about these numbers great for a Melbourne-based race, but if you then head up to Cairns later in the year or the next year and go and race and try and utilize that exact combination of numbers, probably is going to be slightly different because you're utilizing more just because it's hot. Like, so it gives us that ability to narrow it in and eliminate some of the big error. That subtle refinement still is a bit of the art behind it of how it works for you and actually like, okay, do we need to go five grams up, 5 grams down? Like, is it more bottles, more gels, less gels? Like that type of stuff is then you just have to kind of work with the numbers to then get to, well, what is the exact outcome for you? Because that the numbers on paper could look very similar, athlete A, B, C, but then what that translates to on course on race day could look a little bit different because of those individual differences.
And what about a swimmer who may be listening to this and they're not doing triathlons, but they're into the longer distance swimming? How does the testing apply to them? So you said it's on the bike. does that still apply? Like you're looking at heart rate, and then how many carbs they're burning at a certain heart rate. Like how's that work for swimmers?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because it's just difficult to test, right? So the optimal scenario would be for us to find a way that we could test in the water, which most of the tech's not really water friendly. But like where we've done a bit before with particularly some of the open water swimmers on the bikes, probably the like getting them into the lab and looking at some things on the bike, as much as it's not exactly the same, you can then have a look at, well, there's going to be some similarities around, well, what's maybe your heart rate response or your total energy expenditure? What does that sort of break down to? The major difficulty you're always going to find from a swimming perspective with some of this testing, unless you can specifically test at a pool or in the water or at the very least on some form of swimming erg, so to speak. Like I've seen them, you would have seen them, like the pool handle things that look a bit ridiculous, but like that's at least closer to mimic it. That like the specificity aspect is pretty key in terms of like how well you move through the water, because swimming is a really great example, right? Similar, no different to, I guess, cycling aerodynamics, where you move through the water really well, your energy cost is probably going to be a little bit lower for the same speed as someone who moves through the water poorly. So that then plays into total calories, which plays into fat versus carb percentage and ultimately grams of carbs per hour. I've played around a little bit with some more portable devices like that don't measure the carbon dioxide, but oxygen consumption at the pool. And I think that's potentially one further that I want to keep looking at to get some comparisons of, well, what does that oxygen consumption look like from a swimming perspective? It's a bit tricky and it's a bit estimated, but you can get kind of close. But then how do we take some of those numbers and compare that to, say, how the same person would react in a bike test? Look at the oxygen consumption, the energy cost, and try and overlay and match that a bit to get it a bit closer. That's definitely something I'd like to be exploring a bit more in the future. I think that's kind of the practical way to look at it. I mean, you're going to get a good indication, but like we said, like the difference between, say, 160 beats per minute in the pool and 160 beats per minute on the bike for the same person could actually still have quite a bit of variance in how they utilize and fuel. Again, talking about a sport that's very lower body dominant versus upper body dominant, even that specificity is going to throw it out a touch. So that's where it in all honesty, it does become hard. Like, is it something that, yeah, if we had unlimited budget, it would be nice if we could have an endless pool or an ability to be able to test guys in the water, because I think that would be perfect. But also the reality, I think, as well, from a swimming perspective is, and you can ask this probably better for me, is like, hey, for most people, other than if you're going and swimming like an English Channel, right, is it fair to say that like most swimming events, most even like long distance swimming events would be 2 hours and less?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm thinking like a 10K swim, which is kind of the start of what you consider a marathon swim. For most people, that's the elite guys will do that just under 2 hours.
Yep.
So most people will take, probably somewhere in the sort of 3 hours there, I'd think. Yep. So, but yeah, most swim events would be pretty well under that two hour mark, unless they're starting to do marathon swims.
Yeah. And so that's where I go, like the marathon swims become significantly different, but those most of those events under sort of like 2 hours, as we said before, like you've probably got about 90 to 2 hours of carbohydrate at a solid intensity. If you're swimming at a pretty low intensity relative to be sustainable enough, you might want to top up 30, 40 grams an hour, maybe 50 grams an hour. If you feel like you need a bit more, you probably get away with that. If you went higher, like if you're a bigger athlete, you feel like maybe you don't move through the water as effectively as someone else, like you're just sort of powering along, you might want to go a bit higher to 60 or 70. But within that's kind of like, if across that 2 hour period, like if you took say four typical gels, so that's going to be like 24, 25 grams an hour. And maybe you had a way of getting some liquid carbs in, if you could get 250 mils down of a carbohydrate mix in a bottle partway through that, or even across the event, you get through a whole 500 mil bottle of carbohydrate, you might get another 40 to 60 there. Okay, that would typically, for me, probably be more than enough. And again, the time duration is your big savior. So like, unless you're going to go swim for 6 hours, like that's where it probably becomes far more relevant to really be pumping up really specific amounts. But if you're swimming for say like an hour and a half solid distance, major things of make sure you've got enough fuel in you before you start. And then if you've got an ability to take something during, it's going to be useful. Probably no different to like an Olympic distance triathlete. Like it's, for most people, it's two and a bit hours. Like you can get away with taking a couple of gels, but you don't probably don't need to plan it as specifically because of the duration requirement. Like you might be expending a lot, but the duration requirement dictates that you've probably got enough to get you through that kind of event. But yeah, I mean, optimal scenario would be like, if you're doing something longer, like that's definitely, like you're going 4, 5, 6 marathon swim type stuff, 6 hour plus, like, yeah, you probably want to be having a look at like, what are you specifically utilizing at different intensities as best you can? Cause there's just much more risk of you running out of fuel.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I know a lot of and coach quite a few people who are doing those longer swims, and it's just, yeah, something that they've got to really consider. And yeah, I was curious about the testing and the relevance of it if they're on the bike, and whether that just like looking at the heart rate and the oxygen consumption, how well that ties in. But as you said, it's quite a different sport being on the bike compared to swimming. So, and then you've also got the factor of sometimes they're in cold water, sometimes they're in warm water, and that can obviously play a part of it too. So yeah, and it's kind of like, you know, what's the, you know, how does someone swim faster? It's like, it's just so different, right? It's like, that's why you come get a swim analysis, because what you need to work on is very different than another person. Same with the nutrition requirements. So yeah, a lot of different factors there. And just to sort of finish off here, I mean, you've done what you've done for a very long time, worked with a lot of different athletes. What any sort of lessons or things that you've come to learn over the last couple of years where is common knowledge for you and you're like, well, everyone would know this, right? But when you see someone who's sort of brand new and you're talking about this stuff, they're like, my God, I can't believe, like, I never knew this before. And I know I've talked about a few things already, but does anything else spring to mind?
In terms of like fueling specifically or
anything else that comes to mind as well?
Yeah, I think like if you're talking sort of brand new, like you make the assumption that we've sort of got like an amateur there, and I go, most of the time, most people are getting into it think a lot of the stuff that we do, and I do in particular, is exclusively pro and elite at lowest level, if you like, top end age grouper. And it's like, well, no, like the same principles we get from what the pro and elite guys do, we're looking at maybe can I find 0.5%. So great example is take some of the best swimmers in the world. Like, right, the one that always sticks in my mind when I talk swimming is always Michael Phelps, because I grew up watching him. He's unbelievable. But you go, yeah, there's probably a few things we could talk to him about swim technique. But at the end of the day, he's the fastest bloke on the planet. Like, maybe he's doing something pretty well. Like, we might be able to find, we want to find 0.5%, but like, he's already right up there. The bonus of working with someone who's brand new is a lot of the stuff that we do to find that 0.5% in that top end athlete will give the brand newbie amateur like 15-20%, because it's easy wins, right? Mm-hmm. We're looking at, on your side of the technique aspect, I go like, yeah, teach someone to swim properly. Like, is it such a fundamental part of the sport to make them swim better? Like, we can talk about training sessions and zones and all that, but like, if you can't swim, you can't swim. Triathlon and that, no different. Like, cycling wise, the number of amateur athletes who come in and like, we put them through some testing, we're like, gee, you can punch some pretty good numbers. And then you look at their race time, and then you look at a photo of their race, and you're like, on the bike, they move, they're like, their movement and flexibility is pretty good, but they just have never even considered, well, what could I do to be a bit more aero? Because I actually punch some pretty, I can punch some good power, and I fuel okay, and I don't have any issues, and I race pretty okay, but like, they didn't even consider that aerodynamics was something they have to worry about, like choice of skin suit. How many of us as amateurs in the past, you go, I'll just get the one that's on sale. It's like, well, if you spent the extra $50, like that could have actually been a time saver of a minute, 2 minutes. Like, so like things like that, I think like making sure that even as the amateur, is like, you're not necessarily shying away from some of these things that seem complex and sports science. It's like, oh, it's just for professionals. Because quite often, like some of the little things that we can take from that, those learnings will then make big differences. Like number of times we've seen people who just got into running or triathlon, and they come in, they do a test, and then 6 months, look, based on the zones that they've got, they just implement really a simple training strategy, but they've refined it because of the numbers in the lab. They come back in 6 months' time, they're miles ahead. Like that's the type of thing that we're just trying to help accelerate for you by using these principles. Like, there's a reason the things we learn from elite athletes are are useful, it's because like they're the best in the world and they're like, we're finding ways to improve them. If those little things improve them, there's probably parts of that that we can take and implement to the newbie who is then going to get significantly better as a result. Like, it's not going to turn you into a pro overnight. And some of the really refined stuff, probably still we go, okay, we might not use some of that because that's a bit advanced or complex, particularly on the training side of things. Like, I'm not going to ask a brand new athlete to go and do like 30 seconds at 500 watts on a bike, like straight out the gate. Like, yeah, we're going to work our way to that. But like, some of the basic stuff is like, just keep in a zone two. Like, you keep in a zone two that is actually your zone two, not just one that Garmin told you. It's like, well, we actually assessed it and here's the marker and the threshold. Well, if you go and implement that for 3 months, you're going to be significantly better off. So like, that is kind of an overall principle, is the way I approach it. Like, it's no like real one thing. It's just embracing the fact that, yeah, sports science is far bigger than just Olympic level, world championship type stuff. It's like, yeah, it plays a big role there, but what we can learn from those people is just as important to then apply to someone who's getting into it for the first time. Because if you can train a little bit more effectively, I can guarantee you, if you're an amateur who's got to work a 9-to-5 and you go, I can't do 300 Ks a week like a professional marathon runner can, but I can do 50 Ks a week. Well, how do we make that 50 Ks as effective as possible so that you can still rock up to work and not be exhausted and then get home and see your kids and not be exhausted? Like, there's other factors at play. Like, best in the world, sometimes all they have to worry about is wake up, train, eat, sleep, go again.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's where the sports science side just helps dial it in a little bit. You don't have to go overkill, but it's just like taking those little bits and just really like trying to learn the little tips and tricks that'll make you significantly better at your level with the realistic expectation. It's like, okay, yeah, we can probably gain a fair bit out of this, but it's not going to turn me into a pro athlete, and I don't have to be a pro athlete to go and do it. But all I'm trying to do is find ways to get me better. Like, if you look at it like that, that's the best way to approach it.
Mm. Yeah. I remember listening to, like, it was yesterday or the day before, I was listening to a guy who used to be a personal trainer, and he was talking about how over like the 10 years, you know, he'd just get people in the gym, they wanted to lose weight. And, you know, for them, it's just like, it feels like this really big thing. But he's like, well, look, if you just, you know, if you eat less, eat better food, start moving more, it's like, it's really straightforward, right? And so he'd have thousands of different people come in, get these results. And he's just like, yeah, like, obviously that's going to happen. But for that person, it can feel like, you know, really, really big deal kind of thing. And like, it's hard for them to achieve the results that they see with others. But I think the benefit that like we see working with a lot of different kinds of people, it's like, well, if you implement these things, it's like, it's going to happen. It's like, it's not surprising if you follow these steps and have good fundamentals and just follow the basics. And you might not know what the basics are right now, but it doesn't mean that you can't learn them and take them on board. And yeah, you know, given enough time with following those things, then you're going to see the results. It's just not a surprise anymore. So it's a really good point. And for those that are listening, I mean, you guys are primarily based in Melbourne. How can people get in touch with you, go through the tests that we've talked about if they're looking to perhaps work on their fueling or just know what training zones to stick to and that kind of thing?
Yeah. So easiest way to get in contact, my email, nick@metsperformance.com. You can find us on social media. So @MetsPerformance, Instagram's probably the easiest, or on my personal account. But yeah, so like, flick us an email, get in touch. Yes, we are primarily based in Melbourne. We have thought, and maybe at some point we'll try and get interstate a little bit, but it's just difficult with a few other commitments. But yeah, get in touch. Even if you are interstate and you're able to get access to maybe to a university nearby and do some testing, more than happy to tee up something online to have a chat through the data. Because like, sometimes just the way that it is explained or broken down can be the key difference. Like, whether you're in our specific lab and do the test, like, say it's a lot of people who've reached out about setting up their own labs, whether it's overseas, interstate, and they're sort of like, well, running the test is the easy bit, but like, how do you know all this data stuff? It's like, a lot of it just takes time in terms of, we spend a lot of time looking at a lot of data over the years, but breaking down that data and understanding how it applies is the key bit. So even if you've got some data, you're able to go to somewhere that's not us and you want us to have a look at it, like, yeah, feel free to get in touch as well, because like, that can be a really good way, especially for anyone who's listening overseas. I've had that a few times. Go and get a test and then get in contact with us and we can help break it down because as well, we know sometimes you go to a university, it's like they'll do the test or you did as a research study, but it's not really their job or role to explain it because they're worried about just the data collection. Like, that's cool. Yeah, if you're able to, if you want to send through some data and us to have a look at it, yeah, more than happy to do that. But if you are in Melbourne, yeah, coming up to the lab, love to get people in to test it and keep collecting some more data on our end to keep understanding how different people respond. I think that's going to be a key one for us over the next little while, is continuing to see, well, what patterns can we find in different kinds of athletes or similar athletes? And then how can we further utilize some of that data to make better decisions on our end as well?
Mm. Fantastic. Nick, thanks again for being on the podcast. I said we'll go for 30 or 40 minutes, but as always, we know how to go over. We've got lots to talk about, so I appreciate being on the podcast again. Thanks, mate.
All good. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to the Effortless Swimming Podcast. If you'd like us to help you become a faster, more efficient swimmer, go to www.effortlessswimming.com.